45. Graham Session, recording number 11, September 10th, 2012. I'm driving tonight, on my way back home. It's a long, lonely drive with endless stretches of nothingness. Just a well-lit highway and blackness on each side. It can mess with your mind, I can tell you. Do you know why I'm doing this? Why I'm recording these thoughts for you? I'm doing it because you think you know me, but you don't. You don't know anybody, really. And I can prove it to you. Just use yourself as an example. You have thoughts that nobody else knows about, don't you? Thoughts that you haven't shared with a single human being. Not your best friend or sibling. Nobody. And sometimes it's more than thoughts. It's actions. Things you do. You could be the most generous and loving father, the most charitable of men, but if your buddies knew about those photographs of barely legal Asian girls you've downloaded to your computer, they'd remember that above all else. You'd be the pervert first and foremost. So, you keep it a secret. You could be a faithful wife who would never cheat on your husband, but if he knew that you touched yourself in the shower while thinking of the grade school principal or some movie star, his opinion of you would change. So you hide it. You don't share those thoughts because you're afraid your extremes will define you, that people will let those little nuggets overpower everything else they know about you. That finely honed image you've constructed. So you hide. You put on a mask. But don't you see? Nobody can really know you unless they know your extremes. If all they know is the gooey, creamy center and not the ragged edges, the outer reaches of your personality, then they have an incomplete picture, a series of snapshots. And do you think you're special? Do you think you're the only one who hides things about themselves? Of course not. Everyone does. Everyone around you has a sexual proclivity or a sadistic streak or some surrender to temptation that they bottle up inside, that they hide behind their Armani suits or fancy makeup or warm smiles, or polite laughter. You don't really know anybody in this world except, maybe, yourself. So that's why I'm telling you everything about myself. I want you to know me. I want you to know everything. Because you definitely know my extremes, don't you? You know my secrets. Should that define me? It probably will, but it shouldn't. I'm more than just these things you know about. That's not all me. For example, did you know that I would never, ever hurt an animal? Did you know that I sponsor one of those children in a third world country for $30 a month? Did you know that I once paid for a neighbor's funeral and tombstone because his widow couldn't afford it? Yeah, that really fucks with your head, doesn't it? You want me to be some evil person because that's easy to understand. You don't want to know that I can be generous and compassionate. That doesn't fit into your nice, comfortable construct. That doesn't make sense to you because you've painted me with one brush, one color, and there's no room for any others on your mental palette. I just don't think it's fair, that's all. I don't expect anyone to canonize me, but at least recognize that I'm a complex person like anyone else. I mean, at least I've taken off my mask for you. That's more than you can say, isn't it? End.
46. The Cook County Medical Examiner's Office is a great beige cement block with windows that some architect tried to pretty up with an angle or two at the edges. The blast of cold air as we enter is downright delightful. I never thought I'd be this happy to arrive at a morgue. The rental car's air conditioning had coughed tepid air at the four of us on the short drive from the FBI's Chicago office. While Sophie Talamus may be dewy and rosy-cheeked, Denny Sasser, Books, and I just look like blotchy, irritable suits. The harried-looking receptionist shows us to a tiny, windowless conference room. We all sink into the somewhat battered chairs, and I pick up a Vogue magazine, as if there's any chance I'll read it.
"So he killed a couple in Nebraska," says Books, "and then a shoe salesman in Denver."
"Right.
Where's he going this week, Emmy?"
"Like I know. Seattle? Austin, Texas? Burlington, Vermont?" Dr. Olympia Janus finally enters the conference room. She is a handsome woman, tall and straight and strong-looking. Her hair is short and black with strands of soft gray, and she wears simple, square black glasses attached to a beaded chain around her neck. She is wearing sensible shoes, Dansko, and classic-cut gray pants with a blue cotton blouse.
"Hi, Leah,"
says Books. Denny Sasser stands to greet her as well.
"Books and Denny, nice to see both of you."
Introductions all around, everyone shaking hands with her. Dr. Olympia Janus is an FBI special agent and forensic pathologist. The Bureau doesn't often conduct its own autopsies, but when it does, it's usually Leah Janus who performs them. She was at the Twin Towers, she was at the Waco and Ruby Ridge standoffs, she's been everywhere that mattered to the Bureau. This was my one final chance, the one concession I got from Dickinson, that he would let Leah Janus autopsy our two Illinois victims, Joelle Swanson and Curtis Valentine. "If she says there's no foul play," I said to Dickinson, "I'll go away quietly." My heart speeds up as she takes her place at the head of the table and lays two thick case files in the center of the table. She is all business, professional, guarded, but not at all aggressive.
"I appreciate all of the background information you got for me, Denny, on the two victims," she says. "It was helpful."
"That's what I'm here for."
Denny has been doing the fieldwork, gathering whatever information he could about Curtis Valentine and Joelle Swanson while delicately tiptoeing around the local authorities. Leah Janus looks around the room and releases a heavy sigh.
"Well," she says, "you have certainly gone and confused things for some perfectly good coroners."
Is that good or bad? It sounds good, right?
"I've conducted more than 1,000 autopsies in my career," she says. "I've seen people maimed and butchered and tortured, crushed and beaten and cut and burned. I've seen everything, guys. It's impossible to surprise me."
"And? And?"
"After examining the bodies of Joelle Swanson and Curtis Valentine, you can put me down as surprised," she says.
"They didn't die of smoke inhalation?" I ask, jumping the gun, unable to help myself.
"Actually, they did," she says, turning to me.
That's the last thing I wanted to hear, of course. But there is something in her tone, something to the glint in her eyes that tells me I'm still in the game.
"But their deaths were no accident," she says. "These were homicides. And these were the most ingenious, meticulous, and cold-blooded murders I have ever seen."
47.
"I want to make sure I'm on record telling you this," says Dr. Janus. "If I'd received these bodies in a routine fashion without having spoken with you about them first, I likely would have come to the same conclusion as these local MEs did, that the manner of death was accidental."
She opens the first file and passes around copies of photos and forms.
"We have Curtis Valentine of Champaign, Illinois, male, age 39, and Joelle Swanson of Lyle, Illinois, female, age 23.
Dr. Janus continues in a dry, raspy voice, as if she is reading something she's read 1,000 times before.
In each decedent, there is clear soot deposition on tracheal mucosa and the dorsum of the tongue. The soft tissue and blood in the organs was cherry red, which is usually evident with carboxyhemoglobin levels above 30%, and is therefore indicative of inhalation of toxic levels of carbon monoxide and cyanide. All of this evidence, as you know, is consistent with the decedents being alive at the time of the fire and inhaling smoke and other toxic chemicals, which is exactly the conclusion reached by the medical examiners in Champaign and DuPage counties.
We all nod in agreement. She pauses, looking at each of us for just a beat longer than is comfortable. It's pretty hard to make the four of us uncomfortable after the week we've had. It seems as though she's assessing us.
But you told me to dig deeper, she says. So I did things medical examiners wouldn't ordinarily do. For example, I examined the soot in their mouths and throats and lungs more closely. I analyzed the toxic gases present. It's usually carbon monoxide and hydrogen cyanide, of course. Those are usually the main culprits, and any damage caused by other gases is difficult to separate from direct particulate injury. That's the logical assumption. But when I dug deeper, guess what I found?
What? I ask, like an eager student, wanting the gory details to justify my original hypothesis, but not wanting them at the same time, knowing that my sister was one of his victims. I don't know which emotion is causing the buzz in my head, the tremble in my limbs.
The chemical residue in their lungs and throat. It's not what I would have expected based on someone lying in their bed, surrounded by fabric and polyurethane and carpeting and books. What I found was an unusually high presence of sulfur dioxide,
she says,
much higher than you'd ever expect from a normal house fire. It's like, well,
she laughs as if apologizing. It's like what? I ask. She shakes her head.
It's like they inhaled the smoke coming off a tire fire.
A tire fire? I repeat.
Correct.
She gives me a grim smile.
And I saw nothing in the reports or background information that suggested any burned rubber at the scenes.
No, of course not,
says Denny Sasser.
And that's not all,
says Janice.
There isn't evidence of burning inside the trachea and lungs. The smoke they inhaled wasn't hot.
She taps the table with a manicured fingernail.
If they'd inhaled smoke from the fire, it would have scalded their trachea and lungs.
So, what are you saying?
Asks Books. Dr. Janice shrugs.
Off the record, I would say that someone must have created this kind of smoke and forced them to inhale it, to make it appear that they were alive at the time of the fire, so that a medical examiner would conclude that smoke inhalation caused their death. But these individuals didn't inhale the smoke from their house fires. The smoke came from a different source. By the time their houses were burning, they were already dead.
It's as if the entire room collectively releases a tightly held breath. The composition of the smoke and the lack of heat eliminate any possibility that Curtis Valentine and Joelle Swanson breathed the fire smoke. That alone refutes the findings of the coroners in Champaign and DuPage. I note for the first time the drumming of my fingers on the tabletop. Not idle, distracted tapping, but quaking spasms. Hold steady, I warn myself. You need to hear this. Don't think about her. This isn't about Marta. It's about catching a killer.
I assume that's not all you have to tell us,
says Books. Leah Janice lets out a nervous chuckle.
No, that's not all,
she agrees.
If that were all, then last night I wouldn't have had nightmares about my work for the first time in 20 years.
48. We listen with anticipation to the next phase of Dr. Olympia Janice's findings. But make no mistake, we have already scored a major victory. The conclusions reached by the local coroners have been tossed out the window. So why don't I feel like celebrating? Because under the category of careful what you wish for, Dr. Janice is about to give us some very specific details about how Curtis Valentine and Joelle Swanson died, and thus how my sister was murdered too. Each of the four members of our team, in his or her own way, eyes downcast, shoulders closed in, feet tapping,
is reacting the same way right now, even without the personal connection I have. We already know the heights of his brilliance. Now we're going to learn about the depths of his depravity. Janice passes around glossy photographs that, she explains, are close-up photos of the upper thigh of Curtis Valentine and of the areas immediately surrounding the elbows and knees of Joelle Swanson. "Look here at the splits in the tissue," she says. "Splits in and of themselves are normal in a death like this. Heat from a fire will cause splits in the skin as the flames cause the outer layers to fry and peel off. After that, the thicker dermal layer begins to dehydrate, shrink, and split. This splitting occurs parallel to the muscle fibers. Do you see that?"
"I guess I do." It's hard for someone like me to make sense of these photos, but it looks like the skin has split open vertically to reveal muscle in the same direction, like the husk stripped down to reveal the corn.
"That's the key," Janice continues. "The skin splits caused from a fire's heat will be parallel to the muscle fibers. When the splits are caused by lacerations, a knife, some kind of slashing wound, what have you, the lacerations will typically be across muscle fibers. That is a key way that an autopsy will reveal foul play, by comparing the laceration's direction to the muscle fibers. Do you follow?"
"Yes," Book says. "So these skin splits are parallel to the muscle. They look like they resulted naturally from the heat of the fire."
"Correct. But upon closer scrutiny, these lacerations are quite precise. And by precise, I mean of surgical quality. They are even and symmetrical. They are simply too perfect to be natural. And he was clever," she adds. "He chose his spots wisely. These lacerations occur in areas of the body that were nearly completely consumed by fire, leaving little but a greasy layer of flesh over charred bone, or in areas riddled with natural splits in the skin. Whoever did this had solid medical knowledge and a steady hand. Your subject sliced them up, and he did so right where he knew we wouldn't discover it."
I catch my hands trembling again and lace my fingers together to calm them. The slow buzz between my ears, the gentle hum, rises in volume, like the charge off a high-voltage battery.
"I'm sure you've heard of the pugilistic attitude that bodies assume when burned, yes?"
Dr. Janice asks. My mind flashes back to Marta, burned up into a boxer's stance, knees and arms bent, a defensive crouch. I close my eyes and take deep breaths.
"In fire-related deaths, this heat-induced contraction results in exposure of the peripheral joint spaces like the wrists, elbows, and knees, and there is often charring of the articulating surface of the bones. Deterioration of bone here would not be unusual, but look here," she says, pointing to Joelle's elbow joint. "Here, I found that a portion of the bone was missing, while the depth of char is consistent with the surrounding area, as if some of the bone had been removed prior to the fire. The surrounding tissue in that area was profoundly burned, but shows evidence of deep bone-level skin splits."
"Translation, please," says Books.
"Sorry, I'm saying the subject cut through their skin, moved aside their muscle tissue or sliced through it with methodical vertical cuts, and shaved a chunk of their bone off before they died. Basically, he cut them to shreds on their elbows, wrists, and knees. He sliced skin and he removed bone. Imagine someone performing knee surgery on you without anesthetic while you're awake, and you get some idea of what these people went through. Except it was both knees, both elbows, and both wrists. So multiply the experience by 6.
"Jesus, Mary, Mother of God,"
Denny Sasser whispers.
"And he knew it would be nearly impossible to detect because these areas of the body are some of the parts that are most exposed in a fire."
Somehow, my hands have split apart again, resuming their spasmodic quaking. And only now do I realize the lighting in the room has turned a blinding shade of white, and the buzzing in my head has reached a dizzying volume, the odor in the air turning foul and putrid.
"Are you okay?"
says Dr. Janice, presumably to me. My face is sizzling, my stomach in revolt.
"Emmy,"
says Books.
"I forgot,"
says Janice.
There's a personal connection. No, I hear myself say. Keep going. There's more, isn't there? There's more. In fact, this is where the two deaths diverge, says Janice. Believe it or not, this is where it gets worse.
49.
So he didn't do the same things to the two victims?
Denny Sasser asks.
Well, not entirely, says Olympia Janice. Each of them inhaled that smoke, however he accomplished that, and the very painful slicing and bone cutting at their limb joints was present in each victim. But yes, at this point, the examinations of the two bodies diverge. Let's start with Curtis Valentine.
She pulls out two sets of photos from her file.
I found evidence of injuries inflicted at his temporal bones. His skull, basically. You see, there are two skull fractures here and here, she says, pointing to either side of the skull just behind the temple. Is that unusual? Not at all for someone burned in a fire. Heat-related fractures commonly occur in the temporal bone just behind or below the temples. They are normally jagged, radiate from a center point, and may cross those suture lines. For all intents and purposes, these fractures look like normal heat-related post-mortem fractures. Each of the two fractures is jagged and each radiates from a center point. However, she continues, tracing the line of fracture with the eraser of her pencil. Look at the center points of each of these two fractures. They are identical in diameter. Identical. What are the odds that two heat-related fractures in the same individual would have identically sized center points? A diameter, by the way, that is consistent with your average ice pick.
You think he punctured Curtis Valentine's skull twice with an ice pick,
says Books.
In locations where a coroner would blame the fractures on the heat from the fire.
Exactly. And in a location where you would expect to find skin splitting, too. And while we're on the topic of skin splitting, just like he did with the knees and elbows and wrists, here at the skull, he kept the incisions on the skin parallel to the muscle tissue, so it would mimic a heat-related splitting.
The room is quiet a moment. Everyone's trying to keep up with our learned doctor, and everyone's trying to digest this information without losing their lunch. Curtis Valentine was scalped, I say, my voice flat.
Exactly, she says. Our subject punctured Mr. Valentine's skull in two places to get hold of the skin. Then he tore off the skin in patches, inch by inch, like peeling an orange. The skin flaps were left attached to the skull, and as they burned, they flaked away until the damage was easily mistaken for normal fire damage.
Okay, I say, though I'm not sure if I'm saying it to myself, to steady myself, to keep a clinical focus and not think of my sister. And was he, when this happened, was Curtis, was he?
He was alive during all of it, says Janice. The shredding of the skin at the elbows and knees and wrists, the cutting of the bone, the peeling back of his scalp. There's evidence in the histological analysis of the tissue that there was swelling at the sites, which only happens if you're alive.
Don't think about it. Don't think about her. Think about the case, the puzzle, the solve. This isn't personal. This isn't about Marta. Marta. Oh, my poor, sweet Marta.
You're describing torture,
says Denny Sasser.
Torture isn't a strong enough word,
Janice says.
Emmy, are you okay?
I open my eyes into my hands. I didn't realize I'd been covering my face. I squint into the light of the room.
Emmy?
I spin my index finger in the air, hoping that she'll understand that I want her to continue because I'm not sure my voice will work anymore.
What about Joelle Swanson? Books asks. She wasn't scalped?
No, she wasn't.
Leah Janice sighs.
I also ordered extensive histology on her available skin samples, still capable of being tested. Her skin and muscle tissue were nearly completely destroyed by the high heat of the fire, but there are a few sections of deeper tissue on her thighs that show evidence of second-degree burns occurring prior to her death. With enough time, that there was vital tissue reaction, including edema, erythema, inflammation, and hemorrhage. These preliminary burns, in my opinion, are consistent with the damage caused by scalding.
Scalding?
Denny Sasser asks.
As in boiling liquid?
Correct. Dr. Janice clears her throat. He burned her over and over again, but only to a second degree burn.
Why stop at second degree?
She gives a rueful smile.
If it were a third degree burn, all her nerve cells would have died and there would be no pain. A large second degree burn, on the other hand, is a constant source of agony. Have you ever been to a hospital burn unit? That kind of pain will test your sanity and your will to live.
She shakes her head.
He knew exactly how to maximize her pain.
Books clears his throat.
So, he poured boiling water over her. He cut her at the limb joints. He filled her lungs with the smoke of burning rubber to asphyxiate her. And then he burned her up in the fire.
Not Marta. Not Marta. These things didn't happen to her.
That covers it, Leah Janice says. Listen, I'm not sure you understand what I'm saying about the unifying characteristics of these injuries. First of all, every single one of the injuries he inflicted, every single one, could be explained away as having been caused by the heat from an accidental fire. Could we convict him in court based on what I've told you today? No. There are too many holes. I firmly believe in what I've told you, but a skilled defense attorney could tie me in knots because I could never fully discount the possibility of accidental death. But more to the point,
she continues,
each of these acts, each of these injuries was chosen with the specific intention of causing unimaginable pain without causing death. He sliced into their bodies with the skill of a surgeon, and he didn't hit one major artery. They didn't bleed out because he didn't want them to bleed out.
She looks at each of us in turn.
I don't know how you ever discovered this monster or connected these two murders. Whatever you did, I applaud your excellent work, because these are the closest things to a perfect crime that I've ever seen. And they are also, I must say, among the most hideous I've encountered. Our subject has committed unspeakable acts of torture and managed to remain completely invisible.
Dr. Olympia Janice claps her hands down on the table and stands up.
Catch him,
she says.
Hopefully before he does it again.
Denny says,
Today's, what, Wednesday the 12th? He's midway through his second week on the road.
Right, says Books.
Which means he's probably staking out his next victim as we speak.
50.
Graham Session, recording number 12, September 12th, 2012. Hello. Hey, how are you? I'm good, I'm good. Okay, I'm just doing my fake phone call ruse again because I'm at a bar doing my favorite thing, people watching. Do you like to do that? I think everyone does, don't they? Isn't it strange that almost everyone seems weird to you? But you imagine that if the shoe were on the other foot, you would seem normal to them. Anyway, I'm traveling again tomorrow, so I'm not really on the job tonight, but I'm going to show you an example of how I do what I do, how I draw people in, how I gain their trust, because... Are you a writer? I'm sorry. Hey, can you hang on a second? Someone's talking to me. Hang on a second. I'm sorry, what did you say to me? I said, are you a writer? Am I a writer? But why would you ask me that? Because you seem like you're observing people and taking notes, even though you're pretending to be on the phone. I'm not pretending to be on the phone. I'm really on the phone. Okay, sorry I bothered you. Hey, can I call you back? Okay. Okay, thanks. Bye. Sorry, that was rude of me. You don't think I was talking on the phone? It's kind of a weird-looking phone, but these days, I can't really tell anymore. I should mind my own business, really. No, you're fine, you're fine. I'm Graham, by the way. I'm Mary. Mary, Mary, quite contrary. I can be. What is Graham, an English name? Yes, it is. What are you drinking, Mary? Club soda. So, are you a writer? No, I'm not. You want to try another guess? Are you a cop? Nope. Why, do I look like a cop? Not really, but the way you observe people, I was thinking maybe an undercover one, like you're following someone. Maybe I'm following you, Mary. Have you done something wrong I should know about? That's an interesting question. Oh, well, color me intrigued. Do tell. I was just kidding. What have you got to lose, Mary? You don't know me. I'm just a guy at a bar. I might as well be a priest. Confess your sins. I'll take the fifth, if you don't mind. Oh, you're no fun. Would it help if I confess my sins first? Sure. I'm a serial killer. I'm recording my thoughts in my fake telephone for posterity. You know, so they can study me someday at the FBI. How many people have you killed? Hundreds, Mary. You don't look the part. You have a harmless quality about you. That's why I'm so good at what I do. I suck people in. Like you, for example. So you're playing me? Trying to win my trust? Exactly. Did it ever occur to you that I'm a serial killer who's playing you? I guess I better be careful. Tell me, Mary, what are you doing here? A nice girl like me in a place like this? That's exactly what I mean, yes. Well, actually, you want to know? I was on a setup, a blind date. My friend set me up with someone, and I met him here. I work here, so it seemed like a good place to come. We had a drink, and he left. And it didn't go well? Oh, it went fine. He was a nice guy. You say that as if you were disappointed, Mary. Maybe a little. But that's supposed to be what I'm looking for, isn't it? A nice guy? That's what everybody tells me anyway. But you're not looking for that? Well, obviously I want him to be nice. But for me, the main thing is they have to be, well, for lack of a better word, interesting. Not too vanilla. You know, maybe a little dark, a little edgy. You're looking for a bad boy. I wouldn't quite say it like that, but not a harmless guy like me. You can be harmless and still be interesting. Okay, then. What's so interesting about me? Let's just forget it. I'm curious, really. Why do you find me interesting? Not that I'm hitting on you. I'm not. Let's stipulate that there will be no flirting. But I admit, I'd like to hear this. So, you're going to leave me hanging? You're going to leave without... I have an early day tomorrow, but it's been very nice talking with you, Graham. Good luck on your writing, or your serial killing. Mary, Mary, you really are quite contrary. Okay, fine. You really want to know what I find interesting about you? I am utterly captivated. You aren't going to like it. I'll mentally steel myself. Well, it's just something in your eyes, I guess. Like you're wishing for something you don't have. You seem troubled. I hope I'm wrong, but I really need to run along. It was nice meeting you, Graham. Mary, Mary. Mary, Mary. Oh my. End.
51.
This is a good thing. This is a good thing.
Books keeps saying these words into my ear with the soothing ease he'd normally reserve for a child. I stagger out of the Cook County Medical Examiner's office without a word, Books clutching my arm at the biceps and holding me upright. When we reach our car, I rush around to the front of the vehicle and vomit into the bushes, deep, guttural retching as I plant my hands on my knees and gasp between lurches. Books hands me some tissues when I'm done, when it's past, and I clean myself up before he helps me into the back seat.
I'm sorry,
I manage, the only words I utter on the drive back to the hotel, while Books, Denny, and Sophie assure me it's not a problem. But it is a problem.
I know.
Everything has changed. I've changed. Now I've seen up close what he's done. I've seen what he did to Marta. Books follows me to my hotel room and without a word comes inside with me. He puts me onto the bed and sits next to me, one foot on the floor, one on the bed, his hand resting on my arm.
You want anything?
He asks.
Some water?
I don't answer. I stare at the cheesy wallpaper and let out a low moan.
Go ahead and say it,
I whisper, my voice raspy with phlegm.
I'm not going to say it.
He goes to the sink and fills a glass with water, placing it on the nightstand beside me.
At least not until tomorrow.
This is why you don't work on cases with a personal connection. He warned me, and he was right.
You should get under the covers, Emmy. You're trembling.
I'm not trembling because I'm cold.
I know, I know.
His hand rubs my arm, something just short of tender, just shy of intimate. How many times he caressed me that way, once upon a time, in a slower, sexier way.
This is a good thing,
he repeats once more.
Keep that in mind.
I close my eyes in acknowledgement. It's not lost on me, the significance of what happened in there with Olympia Janice. Our investigation has just been given the stamp of approval.
What Leah said in there was right, Emmy. The work you did to uncover these crimes was nothing short of brilliant. You did it all by yourself. You fought against the tide. You fought against the entire ocean. Even I doubted you. But you were right all along. And now we can commit our full resources to catching this guy. We're going to catch him, Em.
I sit up on the bed, feeling woozy, unsteady. Where's my laptop? Books holds out his hand.
Not tonight, Emmy. You need rest.
No.
Listen to me, Emily Jean. You're only human. You've been motoring on a few hours of sleep a night for weeks, months probably, and now you've experienced some real trauma this evening. Give yourself a break. For the sake of the investigation, give yourself tonight to sleep. I'm flying in a dozen agents tomorrow. We have the full resources of the Bureau behind us now. If you really want to catch our subject, you'll have to take care of yourself first.
As usual, Books understands me better than I understand myself. I drop my head back down on the pillow, staring at the ceiling. Books dims the lights.
I'll sleep here in this chair, he says. I'll be here all night with you, okay?
Thank you, I say. He doesn't answer immediately. I feel myself start to drift, my eyes swimming beneath heavy lids. I know that sleep will be fitful tonight.
And I know what I'm going to dream about. We're going to catch him, Em. Just remember that.
And it's Marta, returning to me. The images I've struggled to stifle since Leah Janice gave her detailed recitation. Images I won't be able to avoid when I surrender to sleep. A knife to her kneecap. An ice pick to her scalp. Boiling water from a kettle pouring over her.
I don't want to catch him,
I mumble.
I want to kill him.
52. 19 pairs of eyes, 12 agents, and 7 research analysts are glued to me as I complete my presentation, my map with the blue stars and red stars, my run-through of our subject's pattern, 2 kills a week every week from Labor Day to around New Year's, a slower trend during the spring and summer months.
Questions? I ask. Comments? I look over the room. I know only a handful of these agents, some of whom come from Hoover and some from Chicago's field office. Books doesn't even know all of them, and he was an agent for more than a decade. Books, who is running the investigation, has organized the agents into teams, with a team leader for each one who will report to Books every night. One team is for new incidents, rapid response, for new fires that we discover on the theory that the quicker we deploy to a scene, the more effective our investigation will be. Included within that, the rather fantastical premise that we might deploy so quickly that we could actually catch our subject before he leaves town. Another team will handle old fires, combing through the litany of murders already committed and doing in-person interviews and research to try to dig up a suspect and draw out a pattern. And then we have two teams devoted to the most recent fires, where the bodies are still warm, so to speak, and the evidence the freshest. Team Nebraska-Colorado will handle the double murder of Luther Feigley and Tammy Duffy in Grand Island, Nebraska last week, and the murder of Charles Daly in Lakewood, Colorado 2 days later. And Team Illinois will investigate the murders of Curtis Valentine in Champaign and Joelle Swanson in Lyle. That team will include our original four-person squad, Books, Denny, Sophie, and me, as well as some others. A hand goes up in the back of the room, a man with sand-colored hair in a charcoal suit. Even as my eyes move in his direction, I grimace in pain. Either tiny gnomes are operating jackhammers behind my eyes, or I have the worst headache I can remember. I am hungover from a night of sporadic sleep, breathtaking nightmares, and ever-present nausea.
So, we presume he lives here in the Midwest and he's traveling in the fall.
That's right.
What kind of a job allows you to stay home in the spring and summer but requires travel literally every week during the fall to a different locale?
I shrug. I'm not convinced that he's traveling because of a job. In fact, I don't think that's the case.
Why not?
The agent challenges me.
That's the most logical assumption. He's a trucker or a traveling salesman or something like that. He has an airtight excuse for traveling around the country. Why isn't that the most logical hypothesis? That's what I'd do. If the police questioned me, I'd want to be able to show that I had a valid reason for being in those places.
He wouldn't do that, I say.
Oh, really? He wouldn't do that. And why is that exactly?
The agent folds in his lips as if suppressing a smile and looks around him. The typical special agent bravado. Looky here at this little research analyst trying to play special agent. Go ahead, little lady, teach us all your wisdom. Think about how meticulous our subject is, I answer. Look at the medical evidence Leah Janis found. Look at the surgical detail with which he carried out his torture so that nobody would even see it as murder. That's not a guy who wants to be tied to a paper trail where you could trace his movements week by week just by looking at job orders or some dispatch report. I shake my head and begin to pace as I continue. We know from last year's data, from the patterns of the murders from Labor Day 2011 until that year's end, that he traveled each week to an area, killed two people, and then returned to his hub somewhere in the Midwest before heading out again the next week. He clearly seems to have traveled by car, and that makes sense because he wouldn't want to leave a trail by purchasing an airline ticket. He could take a train, but that's slower, less precise, and also leaves a trail. And I'd be willing to bet that he drives his own car, not a rental, again to avoid a record. I'd go so far as to surmise that he pays cash for everything when he travels, gas, food, even lodging. A man who is willing to go to so much trouble to torture people without making it look like torture? To somehow fill their lungs with smoke from burnt rubber, for example? Or to inflict unspeakable pain in such a way as to mimic injuries from a fire? Is not a guy who's going to be so careless as to tie himself down by a job. No, I say with a sigh. Even if we find this subject, I'd be willing to bet that we wouldn't be able to prove he was in any of those cities at the relevant time, or that he even left home at all. The agent with the smirk isn't smirking any longer, but he's also not willing to give up.
You're suggesting we shouldn't even pursue that angle?
No, please do pursue it. I'm just telling you what I think.
But let's start with Emmy's premise, Books joins in, that our subject goes to incredible lengths to avoid leaving a paper trail. No credit cards, no rental cars, etc. That doesn't mean he didn't still leave a trail, right?
Books points around the room, For the murders last fall, he says. For each week, each area he visited where he committed a pair of murders. Check all the surrounding hotels for people who paid cash during that time period. They'd probably still have to show ID, right? Check for parking tickets issued during that window of time for out-of-state plates. And he would have had to have a large wad of cash on him, right? So before he left town each week, maybe he withdrew a large sum of money from a bank or an ATM. Let's look for that. For each week last fall, a midweek withdrawal of large amounts of cash, probably over $1,000.
I feel a surge of momentum. Good. This is so good. So many smart and talented people putting their heads together. Surely we can think of something. Finally, we're no longer spending our time looking backward, proving a crime was committed. Now we're looking forward, trying to solve it.
We're hoping to have a profile worked up soon, says Books. Until then, every night, team leaders, 6 o'clock Central Time, we video conference.
He claps his hands.
Let's catch a bad guy.
53. The tavern is about three quarters full at 3:57 p.m. There is a standard full-length wraparound bar in one corner, then an open area with some cocktail tables in the middle, with dining tables at the other end. The crowd is a youthful mix, many of them just at the legal drinking age of 21, some a bit older, possibly grad students. Waitresses weave through the crowd holding platters with beers and shots. There is probably loud, lively music playing, but we don't have audio. Just the grainy black-and-white video from a standard security camera mounted in the corner, which has since been downloaded to a disc now spinning inside Sophie Talamus's laptop computer. The four of us, Books, Denny, Sophie, and I, are huddled around the computer screen. With his pen, Denny Sasser points to a man walking through the crowd toward the dining tables. From the view of the immobile camera perched high up at the back of the bar, the man is walking through the middle of the screen toward the bottom right corner. The man is short and bottom heavy, wearing a black shirt and black jeans and a ponytail. The aging hippie.
This is Curtis Valentine, says Denny.
My heart flutters. There is something stirring about watching this man move with such unremarkable ease, a casual gait as he holds his beer carefully and heads to a table, unaware that he has only hours to live. Hours which will be excruciating. The footage comes from Benny's Tavern in Urbana, Illinois, from August 29th, the day that Curtis Valentine was murdered. Valentine continues to walk toward the bottom right corner of the screen until he disappears out of view. He is heading for a corner table, a sensible decision for someone coming here for a meeting. Unfortunately, the security camera isn't focused on that corner. Its focus is the front of the establishment, the entrance, and the wraparound bar where the cashier is located. The owners want to keep an eye on the bartenders and, more important, on the money.
Goodbye, Mr. Valentine, says Denny,
as Valentine disappears from our view.
Go to 4:04 p.m., Sophie, if you would.
Sophie dutifully fast-forwards the video to 7 minutes later, or 4:04 p.m.
Keep an eye on the entrance, says Denny,
gesturing to the top left corner of the screen. The room is quiet. Books clears his throat.
Here,
says Denny, as the door to the bar opens. A man walks in, a profile of his right side facing the screen. He is holding a phone up to his right ear, partially obscuring his face. He is wearing a baseball cap, further shadowing his features. His eyeglasses complete the trifecta of concealment. The grainy video doesn't help either. But we can still see a few things. A male Caucasian, perhaps bald, medium height, with what appears to be a paunch showing through a blue windbreaker.
This is our subject, says Denny.
Nobody speaks, but electricity fills the air. This is our man. This is the man I've hunted for months, in the flesh, so close to us that I have to restrain myself from reaching out and touching the screen. This is the man who has killed and killed again with impunity. This is the man who has committed such heinous acts of torture that he could make a UN Commission on Human Rights Atrocities blush. This is the man who killed my sister. 54.
Hello, scumbag,
says Books to the computer screen. That's the word Books has always used to describe the criminal he's chasing, be it a bank robber or kidnapper or serial killer, a word that is both antagonistic and, more to the point, dismissive, disrespectful, making the crucial if subconscious point to his team that he doesn't fear this man, and thus neither should they. On the screen, the man, our subject, the killer, perhaps the most evil man to roam this earth, remains on the phone, his face angled slightly downward as he speaks and as he listens, occasionally putting his left hand over his left ear.
Bad luck for us, he's talking on a phone, says Sophie.
It's not luck, says Books. He knows where the security camera is. He's concealing himself as much as he can without being obvious about it.
Our subject moves through the crowd, remaining at right profile to us for a time. We lose him periodically for a couple of beats as he wades through people, but then he turns and, for a moment, faces the camera almost completely as he heads to the rear of the tavern, toward the bottom of the screen. Pause, I say, as Sophie is already in the process of doing that very thing. The screen freezes, occasionally twitching. It's the best shot we're going to have of him, but it isn't much. Facing directly toward us, but still the head bowed down slightly while he talks, or pretends to talk, on the phone, the bill of his cap concealing basically his eyes, leaving only his nose, mouth, and chin.
Yeah, he knows where the camera is,
Books says again.
Keep running it, Soph.
Soph, I note, a fleeting thought. Not Sophie. When the screen comes back alive, our subject keeps his head down and moves toward Curtis Valentine's position. For the first time, we can clearly see a bag that our subject is carrying, slung over his left shoulder, no doubt containing his bag of goodies. The educated guess would include an ice pick, surgical instruments, a canister of gas and gas mask, maybe a taser, probably a firearm. Just as our subject reaches the right corner of the screen, he raises his head up and, as best as I can see, ends his phone call and begins to address Curtis. But then he's gone, out of the camera's view. Damn, I say.
You can keep watching if you like, says Denny. But he doesn't reappear until they leave at 5:03 p.m. And don't get your hopes up.
Sophie fast forwards the video to that time. When Curtis Valentine leaves with our subject, Curtis is on the right. Our subject is now walking away from us and, for good measure, has turned to his right to talk to Curtis, leaving us to look at the back of his head and his baseball cap and windbreaker. As the two men move through the bar toward the front door, the top left of the screen, our subject manages to keep his face turned away from the camera's eye and looks quite natural while doing so.
He's good,
says Books. We already knew that. Sophie, can you go back to the frontal shot we had? The screen scrambles, everyone moving backward at rapid-fire speed. It brings back memories of old video footage from my infancy, of my father teaching Marta and me how to walk when we were a year old, a video we watched 10 years later at Christmas. There was my dad, coaxing us along, then letting go of our hands to leave us on our own, twins flailing forward with heavy, awkward steps like drunken sailors, before each of us fell backward on our fannies. I remember watching all of this with Dad, Mom, and Marta, and Dad rewinding the tape over and over again at a high speed, so Marta and I were staggering forward, then falling, then standing up and walking backward toward Daddy's hands. We howled as Dad ran that VHS tape backward and forward repeatedly, kids whose buttons Daddy knew how to punch. The light dimmed in our family room while I sipped eggnog. Marta hated eggnog, but I loved it. The warmth of the crackling fire, and the comfort of those same Christmas stockings we had for our entire childhood, hanging by the chimney with care.
There, says Books.
The screen freezes, sputtering at us. Sophie tries to zoom in, but with the low quality of the picture, too close makes it even blurrier. She works it back and forth until she's found the best shot of our subject she can. The eyes are impossible to see in any meaningful way. But it's not a total loss. The curve of his face, the elongated, delicate nose. Even with the windbreaker, there is some indication of his build, a slope to his shoulders, a narrow frame. It's something. Each of us is digesting it now, wondering if we'd be able to recognize this man if we ever saw him in person. Yes, I decide for myself, but that's my stubbornness talking. Who knows if our subject is really bald? Who knows if he truly has a protruding gut? Knowing this man as we now do, it's inevitable that he's at least somewhat in disguise. Put some blonde hair on him, remove the glasses, add a suit and tie, remove a fat belly suit, and he could probably walk past all of us. I mean, hell, let's say it. He could probably wear the exact same outfit he's wearing in this video and walk right past us. Because he looks exactly like he wants to look. An ordinary 30-something guy. An unremarkable, unmemorable man. A man who is normal. A man who is harmless. 55. Books pushes himself away from the desk where the computer is perched, a bit of frustration in his expression. Denny had warned us there wouldn't be much to this video, but still we couldn't help raising our hopes. The first chance to see our subject in person. The adrenaline now begins its slow, disappointed drain.
We'll have the techies get on this right now, see if we can upgrade the picture quality, he says, breathing out a sigh, letting his nerves settle. But I don't think this will be good enough for facial recognition.
He's right. I don't have great familiarity with facial recognition technology. The IAs, or intelligence analysts, who do homeland security work have far more experience. But I've worked with it enough to recognize its limitations. A profile shot of the subject won't get us far, and even with this frontal image, we don't have his retina or complete shots of many of the other landmarks. Eyes, the full nose, cheekbones. Nor is there any way of picking up his skin texture, be it a creamy, smooth complexion or something ruddier. He just didn't give the camera a good enough peek at him. Books rubs his face with both hands.
We got search warrants this morning for Curtis Valentine's computers, he says. We should have them by day's end. So very soon we'll know the name of the person Curtis was scheduled to meet, the name our subject used. We're making progress, people.
I make a noise, a bit of cynicism. But Books is right. It was only 2 days ago that the Bureau officially recognized these fires as homicides, and yes, we're now starting to produce results. If only we'd moved faster, I say to myself, not for the first time or even the 10th time. It's a familiar refrain running through my mind. All of this delay has led to more and more deaths. I look back at the frozen screen, to the blurry black and white snapshot of our man. He's almost mocking us, coming so close within the range of the camera, but not allowing a good frontal shot, knowing precisely the angle of... Wait a minute. He was here before, I say. You said it yourself, Books. He knew where the video camera was the moment he walked in.
He wasn't in earlier this day, says Denny. We looked at the footage all day.
Then the day before, I say.
Could be, says Books, slowly nodding. Yeah, sure, could be.
I jump from my chair and move into the open space of the room. I'm a pacer when I get excited, as if my mind can't move forward unless my legs do too. He came in and staked out the place. He probably sat at the wraparound bar at the front, got himself a good look around, probably dressed completely differently. Books looks at Denny.
I'm on it, he says. I don't know if they've retained video that far back. We were pretty lucky they still had the August 29th footage. But I'll check right now.
Denny opens his cell phone and walks out of the room. Books catches my eye and gives me a solemn nod.
We're making progress, he says. Just a matter of time before something big breaks.
Good, because it's just a matter of time before he kills again, I say. Like today or tomorrow. 56.
Graham Session, recording number 13, September 14th, 2012. Say it, Nancy. Say it for all of my friends to hear. You believed me. You actually believed that I was selling Girl Scout cookies when I came to the door. Now, if that isn't proof of my proficiency, I don't know what is. Okay, to be fair, I did a little aw shucks routine and said that my daughter was home with the flu and she had this deadline to make her quota, so was it okay if I just sold them for her? And I did have a box of Thin Mints with me. Ha! What a day. The sun is out, the birds are chirping, the leaves are changing, the air is clean and crisp, and Nancy and I are getting to know each other quite well. How could I not be happy? Of course I'm happy. Where does that Mary, Mary, quite contrary get off anyway, telling me that I look troubled? She doesn't know anything about me. Something in your eyes, she said, like you're wishing for something you don't have. What in the world would I wish for that I don't already have? I have my health, thank goodness. I love what I do, and I'm absolutely perfect at it. What else is there in life? You have any thoughts on this, Nancy? Probably hard to talk with the gas mask on. Well, don't worry. It's almost over for you. Just a little bit. Oh, hey. Do you hear that sound, Nancy? Don't go away. I'll be right back. She's a nice gal, this Nancy. Very pleasant and gentle. She had a baby at a young age, so her boy's in college, but she's only a bit over 40. Divorced and unattached. A spinster. Do people still use that term? Spinster? Nancy's biggest fear in life is that her boy, Joseph, won't find someone special. She says that he has trouble with commitment. He had a rough time during high school, apparently, with drugs and a couple of arrests for shoplifting. Her ex-husband is part of the problem, not doing his duty on the child support front and not spending much time with young Joey. But things are looking up for Joey, and he's hoping to be an addiction counselor someday. By the way, not to harp on this, but if anybody's troubled, it's Mary, Mary, quite contrary. When I met her, she'd just been on a blind date. A woman who is so lonely that she's willing to go on a date with someone she's never even met is calling me troubled? I'm not troubled. Go ahead. I can almost hear you saying it. He's projecting his sadness. He makes himself feel better by making others hurt. Their pain is his medicine. Sorry, no. But thanks for playing. What do we have for the losers, Johnny? First, a copy of the DSM-4, courtesy of our sponsor, the American Psychiatric Association. At the APA, remember, if you have a problem, we'll invent a word for it. And that's not all. Next, they'll receive a copy of Dr. Sigmund Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams, featuring cathartic revelations on penis envy and castration anxiety and Oedipal desire. Let Dr. Freud solve your problem today. And if he can't, worry not. He'll just blame it on unresolved sexual feelings towards your mother. Nancy, Nancy, I'm back. You remember our friend the kettle? Now sit still, dear. I'm afraid this is going to hurt. End.
57. I hear the sound of typing on the other end of the phone call. Then Sergeant Roger Bertzos of the New Britain Police Department says to me,
"Okay, Ms. Dockery, I've got your clearance here, so tell me again what you want."
"The fire in your town tonight."
"Yes, what about it?"
"I want you to dispatch someone to the scene."
"We already have officers dispatched."
"Okay, fine. Have them ask the firefighters about the number of victims in the house and their specific location within the house." A pause. I don't know if he's writing this down or if he's expressing his annoyance with me. "And tell them to interview neighbors to confirm with them the number of people who live at that house."
"All right, Ms. Dockery, will do."
"I need the information as soon as you can get it."
"Understood."
It's my third call like this tonight, after hearing of residential fires on breaking news alerts or first responder websites. We know that our subject sets two fires a week in the area he visits during his
fall tour. We want to identify that first fire as quickly as possible, so we're in position when the second one happens. Whether anything good will come of it is another question, but it's worth a shot. So I'm trying to spot these fires in real time. Back when I was a one-woman operation, I was calling police departments the day after or sometimes several days after. Now I'm doing it as soon as I learn of the fire. It is nearing midnight, the final minutes of Friday. My attention span is waning. My eyes feel heavy, my limbs are sore. I'm about 3 levels past sleep-deprived, somewhere between catatonic and zombie-like. But I have to be on my game, because tonight has to be the night. Working backward, it has to be tonight. He never kills on Sunday, as we know. Usually his second kill in the given week is Saturday, which means the first one is earlier in the week, usually Thursday, sometimes Wednesday, like Luther Fegley and Tammy Duffy in Nebraska, but no later than Friday. So it has to be tonight. I push myself away from my desk on the 8th floor of the FBI field office in Chicago. I stretch my back and shake out my hands. In the next office over, Books has just returned from Joel Swanson's former townhouse in suburban Lyle.
Anything good? I ask.
He shrugs.
There was no forced entry, he says. So he somehow conned his way into her house, just like he did with Curtis Valentine. This guy must be a charmer.
I shudder at the thought, but Books is probably right. My cell phone rings. The caller ID is blocked, which tells me it's law enforcement. Take your pick on jurisdiction. I've called thus far tonight police departments in New Britain, Connecticut, Fergus Falls, Minnesota, and Cambria, California.
Ms. Dockery, it's Sergeant Bertzos from the New Britain PD.
Wow, that was fast.
Yes, Sergeant?
Turns out my guys at the scene already knew the information. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm back in my office now, hands poised over the keyboard.
Her name is Nancy McKinley. She lives alone. She is divorced with a son, Joseph, who goes to college in Hartford.
Okay. I hold my breath.
She's dead, he says. They were way too late. Her body was badly burned in the fire.
Getting closer.
She was found dead in her bedroom.
Closer still. On the bed itself, I ask.
Well, let me ask.
In the background, I hear the sergeant on the radio with the officers at the scene. I can hear the response squawking over a radio. Then Sergeant Bertzos comes back on the phone and confirms it.
She was lying in her bed,
he says. And the fire's origin, I ask.
Well, they said it's only preliminary at this point,
says Sergeant Bertzos.
The fire's still raging, but they think it started right there in the bedroom.
I move the phone away from my mouth and shout, Books! Over my shoulder. Then I bring the phone back to my mouth. Sergeant, I say, I want you to listen to me very carefully.